You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On June 15, 2015, Dylan Roof shot and killed 9 African-American congregants at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina. His trial concluded with a guilty verdict on 33 counts, and in January, after just 3 hours of deliberations, the jury of 9 whites and 3 blacks gave Mr. Roof the death sentence. In Prodigy of Hate, an article in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker, Jelani Cobb takes us inside the trial of Dylan Roof. His article is also available online under the heading Inside the Trial of Dylan Roof, The Complicated Moral Calculations That Followed a Horrific Crime. I'm very pleased it has brought Jelani Cobb back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, Dylan Roof has asked for a new trial on what grounds?
I know there were a number of grounds that they were pursuing. I don't know what the specific terms of it were. That was kind of up in the air when I was working on this. But early on, I know Mr. Roof himself made a complaint about ineffective counsel, and that was dismissed. He actually had a pretty, you know, well organized pretty well-run defense by David Brook. And so,
who's kind of a famous lawyer who takes on really tough cases.
He does. And he's known for handling the case of Susan Smith, which some people may remember. She's the woman who drowned her children in South Carolina and then blamed it on the fictitious black carjacker. And he also handled the defense just recently of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who was, you know, one of the siblings involved in the Boston Marathon bombing.
Well, in the case of Roof, he also wanted to represent himself.
Well, Roof did.
Would that have been inadequate counsel?
Yeah, I think that was one of the kind of issues there. But he actually did represent himself for part of the trial. And so initially he was represented by Brook, and then at one point he wanted to fire Brook and would represent himself. And there was a compromise struck in which he allowed Brook to handle the guilt phase, and he wanted to handle the death penalty phase himself, which, you know, and just kind of to make an analogy, is kind of the equivalent, and that in this trial, where there's very little doubt about the guilt, is the equivalent of going to your mechanic and saying, can you give me an oil change, but I'll take care of the transmission myself. You know, the death penalty part was a much more complicated and significant undertaking.
Although some people have suggested that he wanted to have been given the death sentence. There's a martyrdom side here.
Yeah, there's a martyrdom side of it, but I'm not quite sure that added up. And, you know, one of the reasons was that, you know, when you heard his statements, you know, in the courtroom, he kind of talked about himself almost in kind of terms of which he was being victimized. And he said that at one point he accused the prosecution of quote-unquote hating him because they were trying to kill him. And it didn't sound like something that someone would say if they were kind of resolutely and solemnly going to go down the martyrdom path.
Your article raises many questions, and one that occurs to the reader almost immediately comes from your profile of his family. Mm-hmm. He said that he was hoping his actions would be a call to action for persecuted whites, but doesn't he come from a pretty privileged background?
Well, I mean, he doesn't come from an underprivileged background. And so his grandfather is a prominent attorney in the state, and from what I gather, a fairly respected person in the state, and his parents were not together, but seemed that they had a reasonable standard of living. His father at one point owned, you know, several properties around the state. And
he was a contractor.
He was a contractor, yeah. And on the other hand, you know, he describes his life as having been, in his confession, he talked about living mostly with his mother, but sometimes with his father. And he also tells a narrative of his life, of his mother's boyfriends kind of cycling in and out of, you know, the house and wherever it was they were living, and that kind of instability. But certainly when we think about the kind of abject, impoverished conditions that people had presumed about him, it doesn't add up. It doesn't hold up.
And none of those things would lead to the conclusion that whites are being persecuted.
Well, no, it doesn't. But the problem is that you can kind of get the a la carte information that suits the way that you view the world on the internet, and he is very much a product of that. So we've had this conversation about fake news, and he was under the sway of that phenomenon before we were using that term.
Is it partly because he's kind of self-taught, self-educated? He repeated the ninth grade and then dropped out of school. Did he ever go back and graduate from high school?
He did not. And he got a GED, but he did not graduate from high school.
So at the time that he was thinking of committing the murders, was he just spending most of his time online?
Yeah, he was not employed, and he was spending a great deal of time online and kind of found this digital community of like-minded white supremacists. And he quickly grew frustrated with them, as he thought that they were all talk. And if you read his manifesto, he says that, you know, something has to be done about it, and since no one else will do it, it has to be me. And he views himself as a person in a role which kind of history has thrust upon him in this kind of grandiose way.
But he was looking at white supremacist websites like Stormfront,
right,
which
mm-hmm.
is a neo-Nazi. Mm-hmm.
He had an account there, actually, yeah.
And then Council of Conservative Citizens, which is an outgrowth of the White Citizens Councils
right.
of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And what were they telling him?
Well, one thing that he believed was that there was a great deal of crime and violence directed at whites at the hands of blacks. And, of course, that's a very antique sentiment in American history. You know, it kind of goes back to the days of post-Reconstruction, where people believe that whites are, besieged by blacks.
You appear a lot in Ava DuVernay's 13th, her film about the 13th Amendment, and that's a basic theme of that
it
film.
It is. And falsely so. So he believes that, I forget what the precise number is, but it's a huge number of assaults on whites that happen every single day, and the white structure and the criminal justice system will not do anything about it. And he also believed that the vast majority of violent crime that, you know, whites, in which whites are victims, are inflicted upon them by black people, which of course is not true. I think it's about 84% of white people who are killed by other whites, because people tend to kill within their own kind of social, ethnic, economic, and racial categories. And so he held sway. These ideas that held sway were very much contrary to reality as we know it. But within his mind, it was a horrific situation in which people were being slaughtered and no one would stand up in defense of the white community.
My guest is Jelani Cobb, who's a professor of journalism at Columbia University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. We are talking about his latest article called Prodigy of Hate, which was in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker. He's been writing while he's mm-hmm. been in prison. Mm-hmm. What's he been writing about? And does he have access to those white supremacist websites?
Not to my knowledge, but what he has written in his journals has been to pretty much double down on the thinking that led him to commit the horrific acts that he committed in 2015. And at one point when his cell was searched, officers found materials that were very much consistent, you know, with why he did this. And he did express some remorse for what he put his family through, but no remorse whatsoever for the lives of the innocent people who he killed in the church.
So he's still trying to find ways to justify, to convince the world that he was justified in doing what he did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, while you were in Charleston for the trial, you visited the Confederate Museum. What did you find there?
So that was one of the more fascinating aspects of my time there. So this one afternoon, I just stopped in the Confederate Museum, which is maybe 5 blocks away from the courthouse and maybe 6 blocks away from the church where this happened, the shooting happened. And so I'm literally in the middle kind of this situation geographically. And I'm talking to two of the docents there, and, you know, they both expressed very clear sentiments that what Roof did was wrong. Both of them said they thought that he should get the death penalty as expeditiously as possible. And
you say that a lot of the white people you met
yeah.
in Charleston mm-hmm. wanted him to get the death penalty. In fact, a higher percentage than African Americans.
Than African Americans, yeah. Whites in Charleston were much more inclined to see his crimes as warranting the death penalty, and many African Americans had reservations about him getting the death penalty out of a kind of a general principled opposition to the death penalty itself. Now, in the Confederate Museum, however, one of the things I found that were really striking was that they did not see any connection between his actions and the cause of the Confederacy. And, of course, Roof saw precisely that connection. He saw himself as kind of living out the creed of the Confederacy. He had the Confederate flag, and they all said, well, he doesn't understand what the Confederacy was about, and he doesn't understand what the flag stood for and the symbolism of it. And it was a kind of denial. And one of the things I found fascinating was that for all of his madness, he had a more honest assessment of what the Confederacy had actually stood for than many of the more contemporary kind of heirs to that legacy.
Now, that flag, the stars and bars, mm-hmm. It's actually a battle flag, mm-hmm. isn't it? It wasn't mm-hmm. the official flag like the stars and stripes of the United States.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, there are actually several different flags. But the reason I think that our attention has been focused on that flag is that that was the flag that was raised over state capitals in the South in the midst of the Civil Rights Movement, and it was done as a kind of gesture of defiance to the federal forces. They felt they were pushing integration down their throats. And so I think that's why we've been so closely connected with that flag as opposed to the other flags. Even in the Confederate Museum, there the South Carolina flag of secession is the largest flag in the room there, and it's very different than it's a crescent and a palmetto tree and something else there, and I don't remember what all was in it, but it's very different than the Confederate flag as we know it.
In defense of these kinds of symbols, mm-hmm. Southerners will often say, well, we are just looking at our own history, and mm-hmm. you're trying to sweep the history of the South under the rug.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the hard thing about this, and the thing that I find most disturbing, is that when you go back to the Articles of Secession, when you go back to those legislatures, they say specifically why they are seceding from the United States, and they say that it's about slavery. And so what we're talking about, I think, is a kind of dishonesty and a denial. And until we can actually confront, when people say, it's heritage, not hate, and I'm always like, what makes you think those two things are mutually exclusive?
You spoke to Herb Fraser, a black journalist mm-hmm. who grew up in Charleston and has attended Emanuel since mm-hmm. childhood, mm-hmm. about the relationship of many Southerners and the Confederate battle flag.
Mm-hmm.
What did he tell you?
Well, Mr. Fraser had a really interesting perspective. He's a co-author. There are three people who had written a book together about a book called We Are Charleston, about the context in which the shooting happened. And, you know, he is a kind of lifelong resident of the city. He had gone to Emanuel, and he talked about the fact that this history is ever present. It's in the architecture, this kind of antebellum architecture there that is magnificent and beautiful, but it's also hearkening back to this previous era. And we've managed to do this without talking about the moral implications of it. And one of the things I thought that was really most interesting that Mr. Fraser talked about was the fact that the Emanuel AME Church is about maybe a block and a half away from the memorial to John C. Calhoun. Now, of course, John C. Calhoun is the kind of intellectual progenitor of secession and avowed white supremacist defender of slavery and so on. And the monument and the church are in such close proximity. And he had to walk past this monument each day. And he said he and many other African Americans hated this monument and felt like it was scowling down on them.
Although the debate has been mm-hmm. extended now to northern universities.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To Yale University.
Calhoun's name mm-hmm. has just been taken off of a building mm-hmm. at Yale all these years later.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is that this conversation had been going on at Yale even prior to the shooting in the church. And then it picked up more steam in the fall of 2015, where people saw very explicitly this connection between who Calhoun was and what Calhoun stood for, and this, you know, horrific act, and whether or not this is someone who should have been given this position of honor at Yale University.
I'm speaking with Jelani Cobb, professor of journalism at Columbia University, a staff writer at The New Yorker. His most recent book is The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. And he's the winner of the 2015 Sidney Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism for his columns on race, the police, and injustice. The one we are discussing is Prodigy of Hate, his article that appeared in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jelani Cobb. His latest article for The New Yorker is Prodigy of Hate, which appeared in the February 6th issue. It's about Dylann Roof, and I'm sure that throughout the whole trial, you were trying to get into Dylann Roof's head. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to get into his head? I don't mean just for you, but mm-hmm. for anyone who doesn't share his beliefs.
It was almost kind of like a Rorschach exercise that people were trying to figure out what the provenance of this behavior was. And it depended, it very much reflected who you are and how you see the world. So he committed this act, this horrible act, and people were then wondering. Some people said that, you know, his defense kind of implied, although they couldn't say outright, that there were mental health issues, which later documents that came out seemed to point to the court having assessed him as having a number of mental health issues. And other people.
And wouldn't that have been a factor in the final decision?
It could have been, but Mr. Roof was kind of steadfastly refusing to have that information made public. And he did not want, people to think of him as someone who was mentally challenged or who had mental health issues.
On the first day of the trial, the lead prosecutor, Jay Richardson, who's an assistant U.S. attorney based in Columbia, provided details of the crime that had been previously withheld from the press. Why had they been withheld?
Right. I don't know what the reasoning for withholding all of this was, but I do know that when they began talking about it, there were small things that people didn't know that seemed to have to magnify the horror of what he did. So we knew he had gone into a church and that he had shot 9 people, and you know, for nothing other than the color of their skin. We didn't know, for instance, that he had sat in the parking lot for 28 minutes before he did this. And that he had loaded his clips and his gun so that he would have 88 bullets, which was, you know, kind of white supremacist code for the number 88 as kind of white supremacist code for Heil Hitler.
That's because HH, right. H is the eighth
right.
letter in the alphabet.
Right, exactly. And so he wanted to have this kind of heavy-handed symbolism for what he was doing. And yeah, all these things that had kind of cumulatively chilling effect. And I think I mentioned in the article that his mother suffered a heart attack as Jay Richardson was kind of reading this litany of details that about this crime. His mother just sank lower and lower in her seat and then keeled over, had to be removed from the courtroom, and then later was discovered that she'd had a heart attack.
Was she ever able to return to the courtroom?
I don't know if she was ever able to return, but she never did return.
Has she spoken to the press about what her son did, about whether she might have seen signs of what he was thinking of doing?
She had not, but he said in his confession that no one knew what he was going to do, no one in his family. As a matter of fact, he said explicitly that, quote, they wouldn't understand. And so it did not seem that he came from a family in which these kind of views were espoused or supported.
Which is what we usually assume.
Right.
What about the judge? Was the feeling then that he was a fair judge, Richard Gergel?
Mm-hmm. And so he was an interesting figure. And, you know, he had come to, I guess, public recognition or public attention because he had ruled just within the previous year or two in favor of marriage equality in the state of South Carolina. And he had also been responsible for having a portrait of the first African-American judge in the state of South Carolina, having that hung in the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. And so, you know, he's someone who has a reputation for both judicial efficiency, and the trials move, you know, very quickly. He's very serious about making sure things don't drag and how they effectively use time. And for, you know, people thought of him having as a fair to liberal bent and inclination.
He did try to discourage Roof from representing himself.
Multiple times. He said to Dylann Roof on multiple occasions that, you know, you've had very good representation. You know, Mr. Bruck and his team have done everything that, you know, one would expect of a defense attorney. And then finally he kind of pointed to the gravity of the potential of getting the death penalty and saying that you don't necessarily, do you necessarily really want to do this on your own?
The prosecution had many witnesses and law enforcement officials testify. Mm-hmm. Did the defense present anyone?
No, they did not.
That would be an odd situation. Mm. Wouldn't he have tried to get people who would back up the way he was thinking?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that was interesting and kind of jarring at the very beginning of the trial was that Mr. Bruck was very candid, and this was in the guilt phase of the trial. You know, there are two phases, the guilt phase and then the punishment phase. And in the guilt phase, in his opening statement, Mr. Bruck said that it was highly likely that his client would be found guilty, and, you know, most people in the courtroom expected him to be found guilty. And there was an overwhelming amount of evidence to point to this. And
including confessions.
The confession, the videotape, you know, the writings. There was very little room for doubt as to who had committed the crime in question. Now, on the other side, in terms of mitigating for the death penalty, this is where it became complicated because, one, you know, Dylann Roof represented himself for most of that time. And then, secondly, the psychiatric arguments were off the table, that you could not present mental health experts who might have said that this is not someone who was thinking rationally when he committed these actions.
So the thinking is that David Brooke was kind of laying the groundwork for bringing in the mm-hmm. psychological side aspect of the story, but was prevented when Dylann Roof represented himself.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Leading some people to think that he might very well have wanted to be a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know why he decided to drive 2 hours to Charleston in order to commit this crime, and why he decided to kill the congregants of a church as opposed to any other kind of group?
So he said he had chosen the church because of its historic nature. The church was founded in 1822 and had been involved in, had been a site where there had been activity, anti-slavery activity, and Denmark Vesey, who had been a member of the church, was implicated in a large-scale attempt to create a slave revolt in South Carolina. And Mr. Roof seems to have been somewhat aware of the church's historic role. And in addition, he kind of made a list of places that he might want to attack. And, you know, this is the place that he chose. On the other side of it, he wanted to kill people who were good, upstanding citizens to maximize the impact of his actions. He specifically said he did not want to kill someone who was maybe a drug dealer on a corner. He wanted the statement to be made that he had taken the lives of innocent people.
And that was proven when he arrived at the church and given a Bible and welcomed by
the
group.
That's right. They welcomed him. They offered him a chair.
The pastor, that didn't give him any pause.
He said he thought for a minute about it, actually. He said that he had doubts for a minute about whether or not he would do it. And then he overcame them and said he felt like he, quote unquote, had to do it and began shooting.
In fact, he said he had to do it.
He said he had to do it.
My guest is Jelani Cobb. His article in The New Yorker, Prodigy of Hate, appeared in the February 6th issue. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that Brittany Burke, who had served as an agent with the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, testified that 74 shell casings had been recovered from the scene and that, 54 bullets had been removed from the nine bodies.
Yeah.
And there's a list of how many times people were shot, as many as 8 or 9 times, 11 times
11.
In one case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did he shoot them so many times? One shot might have sufficed.
I think one of the things that the prosecutor pointed out was that the person who had been shot the most was the most vulnerable person there, and that was 87-year-old Susie Jackson. And I don't think it's inscrutable. I don't think we really know what animating logic that was, besides a kind of abject hate that motivated him to shoot innocent people over and over and over again.
And it must have been painful to hear some of the testimony of the survivors. Mm-hmm. You recount that Felicia Saunders testified that Ruth paused in his shooting spree to ask Polly Shepherd if he'd shot her son yet, and she testified, "My son rised up to get the attention off Miss Polly, even though he had already got shot." Sanders told the jury, he stood up and said, "Why are you doing this?" And the defendant over there, with his head hanging down, refusing to look at me right now, told my son, "I have to do this because you're raping our women, mm-hmm. and you're all taking over the world." Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then he put 5 bullets in his son.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the more difficult things, just as a journalist covering this, one of the more difficult things was listening to Felicia Sanders relay her son's final moments, because it was such a distinct contrast to the motivations of Dylann Roof, where Roof came to claim the lives of innocent people. Miss Tawanza Sanders, Felicia Sanders' son, had bravely stood up to try to defend someone else's life. And despite having already been shot,
he was shot 4 times.
He was shot once, at least once, first. He had managed to get to his feet and ask Dylann Roof why he was doing this, trying to distract him from killing someone else. And in response, Mr. Sanders was shot 4 or 5 more times. And he had sacrificed his life, to try to save someone else. And it just stood in stark contrast.
I was wondering if his defense attorney said at the start that the verdict was going to be guilty, why even go through having a trial? Didn't Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney mm-hmm. General, think that the nature of the hate crime elements of the case warranted the harshest sentence of the government's disposal? But couldn't the judge just have done that?
So here's the narrative about how we wound up with the trial, which is that neither the state nor the federal government was interested in taking the death penalty off the table. And the defense was interested in a plea deal which would result in life in prison if the death penalty could be taken off the table. Now, specifically the hate crime elements here, because of the way that the hate crime laws work, were not punishable by the death penalty. But Mr. Roof, who was sentenced to death 18 times, was sentenced for kind of adjunct offenses. In addition to the hate crime statutes, there were the commission of firearm felonies, and then also the obstruction of religion that resulted in someone's death. And both of those were 9 cases of that, which culminated in 18 consecutive death penalties being announced.
After sifting through the trial and sitting there, and knowing that Roof has expressed no remorse whatsoever for his crimes, what do you think best serves justice in this case?
It is impossible, I think, to come away with a clean answer to this. And Judge Gergel said something which was absolutely true at the end of this, the trial. He said, there are no winners here. And there was a kind of moral calculation that people had to grapple with, was if Dylann Roof got the death penalty, it reinforced a practice that has deep racial biases. The history of the death penalty, certainly the history of the death penalty in South Carolina, is that it reflects kind of racial biases within the criminal justice system, always has. And if he does not get the death penalty, then it kind of says that a crime in which a black person would have gotten it did not result in it for a white person committing the same offense, and therefore black lives are worth less than white lives are. And so there was no clean way to kind of navigate this without it being morally compromised. And I think that was the nature of the history and the nature of the action that he committed.
Would anyone in Charleston have expressed sympathy for him to you, mm-hmm. An African-American journalist?
No one did. But I do think the closest it came was that on the afternoon, and actually the next day, when people were talking about the impact, lots of the family members begged him to ask God for forgiveness so that he would not go to hell. I think that's the closest we got to sympathy.
Jelani Cobb's article, Prodigy of Hate, appeared in the February 6th issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for the invitation.